In tonight's gospel reading, we heard a story that could be said to describe the birth of the church. Some people reckon the birth of the church took place at the first Pentecost after the resurrection and ascension of Jesus. But if the church is a community of people following Jesus together, then the calling of his first disciples would seem to be the beginning. I mainly want to focus tonight on one of the other readings, our one from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, which focused on law courts and questions of sorting out disputes and disagreements in the church. But it strikes me that the stories of the calling of the first disciples tell us a lot about the inevitability of disputes and disagreements that would need sorting out in the church. It's not quite so apparent in tonight's extract. We only heard of the calling of the first four disciples, and all four were fishermen. Mind you, if you've spent much time with fishermen, you'll know that they can be an argumentative bunch, especially when comparing stories of the size of their biggest catch. But at least these guys had already learned to get along with one another well enough to spend long days and nights in one small boat together without killing each other. They had worked out how to cope with each other. But next week we will hear of Jesus calling a tax collector named Matthew to join his group of followers. And before long he's also called a bloke called Simon, not Simon the fisherman, another Simon, who was a member of a feared patriotic terrorist group called the Zealots. And because Matthew was collecting taxes for the Roman occupation forces, he was despised as a collaborator and was exactly the sort of person that the Zealots would target, usually with a knife between the ribs in a busy crowd somewhere. So when Jesus calls both Matthew and Simon to join his group and follow him together, it's a bit like calling a militant Muslim drag queen and a member of the United Patriot Front and asking them to sit together in the bus and become buddies. It's not going to go smoothly. Matthew and Simon may be the most extreme example of this in Jesus' original group, but they don't represent the exception. They represent the rule. Jesus and the apostles speak regularly about the gospel as being the gospel of reconciliation. And that's because reconciliation between people who would otherwise be divided and at war with one another is at the heart of Jesus' mission, and therefore of the reason for being of the church. There are churches today that utilise a church growth strategy called the homogeneity principle, which says that each church should target a very specific demographic and seek to draw the majority of its people from that demographic because people like hanging out with other people who are a lot like them. And therefore, they are more likely to turn up to church regularly if most of the other people there are their kind of people. Now, I'm not going to reject that principle entirely because I accept that when, for example, a group of people doesn't speak the language of the dominant culture around them, they're probably going to need to meet for worship in their own language group. And I accept that when a group such as the LGBT plus community has been refused welcome in the mainline churches, they'll probably need to form their own churches until the tide turns, as it is now beginning to do. So I understand that sometimes creating churches around shared similarities is necessary for a while, but it seems to me that if it is promoted as the normal approach, it is in fact a betrayal of the fundamental nature of the gospel as a call to reconciliation across everything that would divide us. Church congregations should feel kind of odd and awkward. I think we're quite good at that. Because they should have a lot of people in them who are nothing like you, who seem different and difficult and annoying, and who you need to work hard to understand and appreciate and get along with. If the biggest thing that we differ over here are our preferences on which hipster cafe has the best soy latte, then we've probably missed the point of the kind of community that Jesus has called us to be. We're probably not doing much of the hard work of real reconciliation where it really matters. Did you hear the description at the end of our gospel reading of the kind of people who came flocking to Jesus as his fame began to spread? It said that people who came to him from everywhere, bringing all who were suffering from every kind of sickness, mental, emotional, physical, or demonic. Now, if you're drawing a crowd of the mentally ill, the emotionally broken, the physically sick or disabled, and the demonically tormented, it is not going to be an easy, naturally cohesive congregation. But if our churches are not drawing the sorts of people that Jesus was drawing, are we really following in his footsteps? If we're serious about doing the work of reconciliation and becoming people who are really proficient in the art of reconciliation, then we ought to be grateful for the presence of the difficult and challenging people, the people we find hard to understand and to get along with. Because they are the people who are giving us the opportunity to identify the parts of ourselves that are not yet cooperating with the gospel call to love, mercy and reconciliation. They are the people who are giving us the opportunity to learn and grow and become more like the people that Jesus has called us to be. So in the reading that we heard from the Apostle Paul, he was expressing his outrage at the news that some of the Corinthian Christians had ended up taking their disputes with one another to court, to the secular law courts. And one of the things to note about this is that Paul is not objecting to the fact that they have disputes and disagreements. That's just a given. His objection is to their failure to work the disputes through to reconciliation within the church community. And his objection is twofold. Firstly, he regards it as an outrageous failure that they would not have people in the church who were wise enough and sufficiently experienced at conflict resolution and reconciliation that they could help other church members work out their disputes. And secondly, he regards it as a failure of love and mercy that even if they can't sort it out in the church, that they would resort to the costly and hostile path of calling in the lawyers instead of just sucking it up and turning the other cheek. Paul explains the first one by appealing to a then common belief that there would be a coming day of judgment on which God's people would be the ones sitting in judgment on the rest of the world. But you don't have to buy into that particular image to understand the point that he's making about the church. He's saying that if reconciliation is at the heart of the gospel, then the church should have plenty of people who have become quite good at conflict resolution and would make excellent mediators when other Christians are in dispute. If this isn't one of our strengths as a group, then what sort of gospel community do we think we are? Paul's second grounds for objection, that of calling in the lawyers, is something that needs some careful conversation in our rather different day and age. Because firstly, today's legal system, while far from perfect, has been far more shaped by centuries of Christian reflection on the nature of justice and the need to protect the vulnerable than the courts of the first century Roman Empire. So things have changed, but that doesn't change the fact that our churches should be good enough at mediation and conflict resolution not to need to go down that path. But what are we to make of Paul's anti-law courts position in light of the recent Royal Commission findings into abuse and cover-up of abuse perpetrated by church hierarchies? I mean, the Royal Commission itself is a secular court. And one of its major findings is that churches cannot be trusted to properly investigate and deal with corruption and abuse in-house. Church organisations repeatedly claimed to be sorting these things out appropriately through their own internal mechanisms. And the findings were that these were usually a disastrous failure. So what would the apostle have to say? Well, firstly, not only have the courts changed since Paul's day, but so have the churches. Back then, the churches were fledgling local gatherings of believers, and there was no significant organisational structure binding them together. There were no major denominational structures with wealth and property and influence and reputation to protect. Wealth and power breed corruption, and church hierarchies are far from immune. So I suspect that the Apostle Paul would recognise that while his words in this passage might still be perfectly applicable to a dispute between two church members of roughly equal status and power, the grossly unequal situation of a church hierarchy closing ranks and trying to silence a vulnerable victim of horrendous abuse is an entirely different situation. There's still a role for in-house and investigation and action, though. And one of the things that has improved greatly in recent years in most church denominations is the policing of ethical standards for pastors and employees and the formalising of complaints and appeal procedures for when abuse occurs. So, for example, if any of you were to have a genuine complaint against me, if you either can't take it to the host group or you've tried that without satisfaction, then the duty of care page on our church website will give you the contact details for the Baptist Union's professional standards worker, and she's quite capable of convening a panel with powers to investigate me and hold a hearing and, if need be, either stand me down or hand me over to the police or both. Those sort of structures did not exist when Paul was writing. If they had been, they probably would have pleased him because they were an example of what he is calling for, and that is for the church to develop the ability to deal with disputes itself. But I have no doubt that he would also recognise the frequent need to have an external judge when the church hierarchies themselves are part of the dispute. And so they can't investigate themselves or in situations of genuinely criminal abuse. The findings of the Royal Commission, although very confronting and humbling for the churches, have actually been a gift from God to the churches, calling them to deal with the corruption in their ranks and to return to their true calling as the pace setters in balancing justice and mercy in a community of healing and reconciliation. And as I've already suggested, at the local congregational level, that begins not with formal structures and procedures, but with a welcoming of diversity, a commitment to extending real care to everyone, and a passion for dealing with the little things that might divide us, however hard that might sometimes be, so that we can be reconciled across everything that would seek to divide us. Because that is the heart of the gospel. And it's to that life of reconciliation and peacemaking that Jesus has called us to follow.